This is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, March 31st, 2021, a day for everybody in baseball to take a deep breath before kicking off the season tomorrow. Producing the podcast from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, and I'm not in my home studio in New York. I'm in Washington, D.C. Taylor?
Ooh, I'm a little bit jealous, not just because you're out of the house, but you are in my beloved District of Columbia. How were your travels down there?
It was really funny because it's the first time since I got on a plane since mid-March of last year. And, you know, I traveled for years and years and years, and it was just part of the rhythm of things. And last night and this morning, like preparing for this trip, I felt completely discombobulated. I was going, I'm like, oh, my God, what am I supposed to pack? What should I take? What do I need? And sure enough, when I got here, I forgot to bring ties.
So oh,
I've got,
no.
Like, shows that I gotta have ties with, and so as soon as I'm done here, I gotta run out and find some ties here in DC. Got any advice?
I believe if it's not closed down, who knows with COVID, but there's a Macy's downtown that's not too far from you, an easy cab ride, or if you want to risk the metro there. But we'll talk after we close up the mics.
I think I'm gonna go for a walk, and weather is coming in, so as soon as I'm done the podcast, I'm gonna be running out in search of ties. All right, some of the notes for today. Mike Soroka, of course, one of the guys at the front of the Atlanta rotation, continues his comeback from his torn Achilles tendon from last year. He pitched two innings for the Braves yesterday. Here's some of what that sounded like.
0-2 pitch on the way. Swung on and missed, strike three. Takes care of Jeter Downs. And no problem for Mike Soroka as he fans Downs on the slider. And one down here in the sixth inning.
Pretty cool for the Braves to get Soroka back on the mound. The Tampa Rays G-man Choi is set for arthroscopic knee surgery. He's expected to be out 3 to 5 weeks. Sounds like it's kind of a similar injury to what Luke Voit had with the Yankees. Miguel Cabrera is going to be playing first base for the Detroit Tigers this year. According to his manager, A.J. Hinch, having Cabrera at first gives the Tigers the best chance to win, quote unquote. The Toronto Blue Jays will play their third homestand of the season at their spring training ballpark in Dunedin, Florida, because of the COVID-19 restrictions. Toronto announced February 18th that its first two homestands will be at TD Ballpark, and now they've added a third homestand. We'll see if during the course of the year restrictions in Toronto loosen up and the Blue Jays perhaps could play some of their games actually at their home ballpark. Let's get to the good stuff, like Mookie Betts yesterday.
That's amazing. Betts, it's a fly ball to deep center field. Mike Trout's back. He's at the wall. Mookie Betts with a home run.
Well, 9 home runs in the freeway series for the Dodgers. 7 different players. And now
Joe Davis and Oral Hershiser in the Dodgers television network, and that rally was not over.
It's a high fly ball down the right field line. If it's fair, forget about it. It is a fair ball and a home run. Back-to-back games with a home run for Bellinger. These guys are ridiculous.
Yeah, the Dodgers are ridiculous. And I wonder, when we talk to Dave Schoenfield, if he's going to have a bold prediction involving the Dodgers about how many wins they're going to have or what the run differential is going to be, because they look crazy good. Let's double back on that Braves game. Ozzie Albies had a moment.
Pitch on the way. Ozzie hits one hard, deep left field, back towards the wall. This one hits a fan at the top of the monster. That's a 3-run home run. That got up in the jet stream and just took off. And another apple knocked out of the baseball orchard by the Braves this spring.
Now today, Jun Lee of ESPN will join us as we continue the American League East previews. We'll be talking about the Boston Red Sox with him. We'll be talking with Paul Ambichides and David Schoenfield. Before we get to all that, a reminder, fight fans, if you want the best UFC experience, you need ESPN Plus. With every pay-per-view event, live fight nights, exclusive originals, and an extensive archive, ESPN Plus delivers. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com.
And Buster, if I could add on to that
quickly here. First of all, again, bevy of games on opening day on ESPN. You've got Blue Jays at Yankees at 105, Dodgers at Rockies at 410, Mets at Nationals at 709, and Houston at Oakland at 1007. All of those times are Eastern, and you can also listen to Mets at Nationals on ESPN Radio. You can tune into that at 6 p.m. Eastern time for full coverage. And don't forget to listen to Courtside with Greenberg and Dokich. I will be recording two episodes with them as soon as we wrap up here. We're going to be talking to newly minted Indiana basketball head coach Mike Woodson. Great get there. And we're also going to preview the Final Four. So please follow, rate, and review that podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply.
Dogs are an important part of our lives. That means protecting them from parasites. Ask your vet about NexGard Plus, a Foxaloner, Moxidectin, and Pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus Chews provides one-and-done monthly protection against fleas, ticks, heartworm disease, roundworms, and hookworms. Plus, they're delicious and easy to give. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurological disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive. Ask about NexGard Plus Chews.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show, mate.
Welcome to the show. Whoa!
Welcome to the show, baby.
You're in the show with David Schoenfeld.
And David Schoenfeld covers baseball for ESPN. And David, how you feeling as we're day away from opening day?
I'm getting that itch, Buster. I'm tired of these meaningless spring training games. I want some baseball that counts to rev us up tomorrow.
Is there any way you could FedEx me a tie today, because I gotta go find a couple ties for shows this weekend.
I'll go buy a couple of those $200 ties from the hotel gift shop. That'll hold you over.
Oh, well, yeah. I think the way that we are now in COVID, with COVID-19 situation here in DC, probably the only thing you can get the gift shop now is like a box of Pringles. I don't know if there are many ties floating around. All right. So yesterday, amid the ongoing question of whether or not Francisco Lindor will agree to terms with the New York Mets, I did Michael Kay's show. Michael's been around the block a few times. And he had an interesting point yesterday when I went on his show that he sort of suspects that perhaps all of this talk, the Lindor and the Mets, and will they agree? And Lindor is asking for 385, and the Mets have offered 325. He thinks the deal's already done. Like, he thinks this is all drama for back pages. I don't know, because that's not what I'm hearing from sources. I'm hearing there's actually a separation, and agents who are watching this, who are not involved in these talks, say, oh my God, you have to get this done. With any offer over 300 million, you have to find a way to push it across the line. Where do you stand in your observations of this?
Yeah, I don't know why the Mets would drag this out for, publicity, but I get it. New York's a different animal. But no, I think they're still trying to arrive at that right number. And frankly, the 385 that we're hearing for Lindor seems a little high to me. I mean, that's more than Mookie Betts. And no offense to Lindor, he's a great player. You know, I'd rather have Mookie Betts. You know, he's a better offensive player than Lindor. So I think Lindor is going to have to come down 325. I don't know how he doesn't eventually take that money, because I don't know, with so many shortstops on the market in the offseason, how that's going to affect what the upside is for the money for all these guys. You know, why give Lindor 325 if you can get a Trevor Story or a Javier Baez for potentially less than that?
Now, part of Michael's theory, and I want to run this past you, in his belief that perhaps this has already been agreed to, is the fact that Steve Cohen's been so out there on social media and making references to it and kind of playfully talking about it. I can tell you that there are agents who feel like that what Steve's doing is trying to put pressure on the kid to agree to a contract. What do you read about all his machinations?
Yeah, that could be. What, he did a YouTube Q&A with fans the other day, so you don't see too many owners going out there like that, that's for sure. It could be. Look, you know, the Mets, of course, they want to get this done. They want to lock him up. They don't want to have to worry about who their shortstop is for 2022 and beyond. And, yeah, you're putting a lot of pressure on Lindor to turn down a lot of money, you know, so you put that pressure on, and better chance that Lindor, you know, stays in New York.
Some of the observations that I got from agents, I touched on a little bit of this yesterday. They look at the situation and they say that Lindor's camp has to look at the current circumstance and say, okay, in this negotiation, you are the one Lamborghini on the lot. You're the only player that they're talking to at the moment. You have a highly motivated owner who just bought the team, who's under some pressure from the fans. It's New York. And even if you get a little bit less than what you feel like you could get, the fact is that being in New York, you're going to have more opportunities. As one agent texted me, what else is he looking for?
Right. Yeah. Who else out there is going to give him that kind of money? The Dodgers already have one mega contract on the books, and we know they don't like to give those kinds of deals, and they're probably going to try to re-sign Corey Seager anyway. The Yankees, unless they decide Gleyber Torres isn't their shortstop long-term, which is possible, you know, so they might not be in the running. You know, who else is going to offer $300 million? The Texas Rangers, although they're already linked to Trevor Story, who's from the Dallas area, so you get past those teams, I don't know who else is going to give Francisco Lindor $325 million.
Another shortstop also in the news. The Astros front office acknowledged yesterday that they've reengaged with their shortstop, Carlos Correa, who is a potential free agent at the end of this season. The Astros' initial offer to Correa was $120 million. He basically gave that the back of his hand in talking with reporters, saying it was way too light. And that was the reaction I heard around the industry as well. I got to believe that if the Astros offer starts at $160 million, then maybe Correa gets more interested. And I, you know, I say that in part because of this long history of back injuries that he has. It's, right. It's a question that teams bring up to me with me all the time. And the question of whether or not Carlos can stay on the field. Look, we've seen him in these moments in the postseason. He clearly is ready for a prime time, ready for a prime time player. He's had great moments in his career. He's put up big numbers when he's on the field, but he hasn't been able to stay on the field. And the perception is, look, if you give him $160 million to start in this conversation, you might be able to get something done, because he knows the risks. He's a smart guy.
Yeah, I saw one statistical projection that said he would be worth a six-year, $180 million deal. And that's factoring in his injury history. But those injuries are still a huge wild card. Sure, if he plays out this season, stays healthy, plays 150 games, his value is going to go way up. But if he gets hurt again, it's going to go way down. You know, there's some concern with his size and those back problems. Is he going to stay short at shortstop, you know, for the next 6 or 7 years? So his situation to me is much different than Lindor, who's a reasonable bet to be a very good to great player for a long time. There's just a lot of concern with Correa. So, yeah, I think if the Astros bring that money up a little bit, I think he re-signs there.
And I've had agents tell me you cannot underestimate the impact of personal rivalries, even if they're friendly rivalries. So in other words, Lindor sitting there at 325 with his offer from the Mets, and maybe there's a part of him that would like to be 340 because that's what Tatis Jr. got. and when I saw where Correa is, I thought, you know what? Longtime teammate of George Springer. George Springer got $150 million from the Blue Jays. Maybe if the Astros find a way to give him a bigger offer than what Springer got. Because I think, as I say, the agents tell me, yeah, those are factors. They want one nickel more. I never forget when Alex Rodriguez was a free agent. You'll remember this well, that the deal that he got from the Texas Rangers was exactly twice the previous biggest contract for a professional athlete in the United States, which had been Kevin Garnett, got 126. And Scott Boras arranged Alex's deal with the Rangers so that he would get 252. Yeah. These little benchmark things mean something to these players.
No, you're right. The egos, we can't deny that they're huge. And especially if Lindor does sign and there's a three in front of that, and Tatis signed with a three in front of that, you know, Carlos Correa's ego is going to want a two, right, Buster? You know, so him settling for a one, maybe he rolls the dice and gambles on himself having a big year. And he could do it. You know, when he's healthy, I think he's every bit as good as Francisco Lindor. It's just staying healthy.
All right, give me some bold predictions for this year. And I wondered as I was going through the opening highlights whether or not the Dodgers would be in there, because there are certainly opportunities to go bold predictions with the Dodgers. What do you got?
So, yeah, I want to run these by you. My bold predictions aren't stupid crazy, but, yeah, for the Dodgers, I have them winning 110 games, which that'd be the most in the National League ever in a 162-game season, most in the NL since the 1909 Pirates. I mean, it's crazy, but I think it's reasonable.
I'm right there with you. Absolutely. And I think, you know, the Dodgers won the World Series last year, and because it was a 60-game season, we mostly, I don't want to say dismissed it, but we didn't dig into it as much as we would have in other seasons. But the way they dominated teams during the regular season last year, during those 60 games, I think we kind of – That was lost on us a little bit, and it's possible they're going to be better this year. So I am right there with you in terms of going bold on the Dodgers. I wrote a thing the other day that it wouldn't surprise me if they were to challenge the standard of the 98 Yankees, 114 wins, the 2001 Mariners team, near and dear to your heart, with 116 regular season wins.
Yeah, and those teams by far, Buster, you'll agree, just they played absolutely – perfect baseball, offense, defense. They got on base, you know, home runs. They did it all. And that's what this Dodger team can do. And David Price and Tony Gonsolin are in the bullpen. That's how deep they are with the pitching staff. Sticking in the NL West, I have the Padres at 100 wins, franchise record, but man, 10 games behind the Dodgers. But if they then win the wild card game, that would mean that San Diego and L.A. don't meet in the NLCS, but they meet in the division series, which would be kind of unfortunate, I think.
It would be, and I'm right there with you. I actually did radio in Las Vegas the other day with my old friend Ed Graney, and his co-host is a big Padres fan, and he was like, so tell me. And I said, I'm going to give you two facts that seem contrary to each other. I think the Padres are the second-best team in baseball, and I think they're going to finish double digits behind the Dodgers. So you and I are thinking exactly along the same lines. And I mentioned the Dodgers dominance. I didn't have these numbers up in front of me when I went down that thought trail. Last year, their run differential for 60 games was plus 136. Okay. Yeah. So that's like a plus 360 over the course of 162. That is staggering.
That's insane.
Better than they were. And yeah, it absolutely supports what you're saying about the Dodgers and what you're saying about the Padres as well, perhaps being a great team but still finishing behind the Dodgers.
All right, here's one maybe that you'll disagree with me on, I think. I have the Cardinals going 80-82, their first losing season since 2007.
I disagree with you on that, and not because the Cardinals are inspiring me this spring. I'm worried about their rotation. Yep. You know, we had Derek Gould on the podcast last week, and he outlined all the injury issues they have, and, boy, they're counting heavily on Jack Flaherty, and Everybody I talk to who knows the numbers keeps on talking up the Brewers, but the division is so mediocre. You know, the Pirates are going to be awful. I think the Cubs are going to absolutely look for an opportunity to sell. And we're talking about like mid-June. And the Reds have not had a good spring training in terms of getting answers. And so I have a hard time believing in a bad division that the Cardinals would just win no more than 80 games.
Yeah, I'm not real confident on that. And I say that I think Arenado is going to be great. And they catch the ball, and that will cover a lot of maybe the holes on the pitching staff. And I'm with you. If the Cubs sell and the Reds, we're already seeing Sonny Gray and Michael Lorenzen are going to start the year on the injured list. So they're already hurting, not major injuries, but yeah. So I'm not confident on that, but it's more a sign of, yeah, that rotation has some question marks. Juan Soto, I know you guys talked about him the other day. I have him 345, 43 home runs. Only three players in the last 20 years have hit at least 340 with 40 home runs. Miguel Cabrera did it once. Albert Pujols way back in 2003, and Barry Bonds a few times. I guess the question is, you guys talked about, will he get pitched enough to hit 43 home runs?
Those are great numbers because I think he's going to hit 343. I think he's that good of a hitter in terms of his average. The question that always pops up with these guys who don't get pitched to on a regular basis are, you know, the counting numbers. You know, do they get pitched to enough to compile 43 home runs? I'm going to say no, but I think it's going to be really close. What do you think the impact of Josh Bell batting behind Soto is going to be? Because I don't see that as being a deterrent.
Yeah, no, it's not. I always remember something Curt Schilling once told me. He always thought for a great hitter, it's more important who's in front of you. Because if the guy in front of us, Soto, gets on base, Schilling's belief was you have to pitch to him. I can't pitch around the great hitter. Then you have two guys on base, and then you're exposing yourself to a big inning. So if Trey Turner has a year like he did last year and he's getting on base all the time, I think that's really going to help Soto. That's going to force pitchers to pitch to him a little more, because I'm with you. Josh Bell's not a deterrent, even if he bounces back and hits like he did a couple years. So if those guys in front of Soto are getting on, that actually may help him get a few more pitches.
Yeah. And by the way, Josh Bell has looked great this spring.
Yeah, he has.
He's working with Kevin Long. You can see with the swings he's taking the ball left center field, and he has absolutely been phenomenal. All right, I'd give you like an A- on the boldness of those picks.
All right, we got to do one more. Mets over Twins for the World Series.
That is way too bold. That's it. You jumped on the crazy train with that one. See, the Twins, the one thing I'd say about the Twins is it's not like we're looking at the American League as seeing the dominance at the top that we are in the National League.
Yeah, that's what my feeling is. If the Yankees click, you know, as everybody's predicting, they look like the potential powerhouse, but they obviously have huge injury concerns with Judge and Stanton in the rotation. I think people are underestimating the Twins. I just like that depth on their roster. Obviously, we all know the red flag there, 18 straight losses in the playoffs, but I'll leave you with this. Last year, I predicted three times spring training, summer camp, start of postseason. I had Dodgers over Rays in six. So, listeners, I nailed it last year. Mets over Twins in seven.
What could I possibly say to counter that? Okay. You just dropped the mic on me. I should have just ended the segment when you said that and just left it. Dave, thanks for doing this.
You bet, Buster.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes. The clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirectTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Jumping into the numbers. This is Himbo Knows on Baseball Tonight.
And Himbo is Paul Imbakite. He's a researcher for ESPN who's a honcho on the show Get Up. He tells us he's the head honcho, and Mike Greenberg completely disagrees with him. We're not going to get into that or settle that here. Himbo, we also are not going to be the people who settle the Francisco Lindor contract talks. A lot of the question that it's been interesting as we've come down the stretch with these negotiations and with the, you know, the first pitch deadline is if Lindor were to turn down in the end the $325 million offer from the Mets, how much would be at risk for him in doing that? You know, knowing that he turns 28 in November when he theoretically could become a free agent. He also would be in a market in the fall that would include Carlos Carrasco with Javier Baez, with Trevor Story and Corey Seager, meaning he wouldn't be the only Lamborghini in the lot. How much risk do you see?
More than I may have thought if you asked me that question a year or two ago. And here's why. As much as I like the player and I think he is outstanding and a top 10 player, at least when he's playing as well as he can, he's really only had, Buster, one truly standout season as a hitter so far. So what that tells us is in 5 of 6 seasons in which he's played, he's just been, you know, about above average, something between 10 and 20% above average as a hitter. And we know that over the course of time, speed and defense wane. So as he's doing all of this math and he and his agent are going back and forth, I think there's actually a very wide variance here for Francisco Lindor, which is to say, if he has an outstanding season, hits the free agent market, it's very possible to me that a contract that starts with 4 is on the table, which is to say $400 million. That's not out of the realm of possibility by any stretch in my judgment. It is also quite reasonable to me that if Francisco Lindor just duplicates the batting line that he generated last season, and you're looking at a 7-year sample size in which he's only been, you know, 30% above average one time, then something that starts with 2 seems a lot more realistic and maybe something that's closer to 200 than 300. So there is a lot at stake here. And should Francisco Lindor play the season or choose to play the season leading up to free agency, I'm not sure there's any player in this year's market who's playing for more money than he is. And ultimately, the offers that the Mets have put forward and the offers that sort of we're seeing, you know, in the public eye at the moment, you know, through all these leaks and such, sounds to me like the kind of contract that would be reasonable even on the free agent market. This is not a case in which, you know, the team is looking for to do a team friendly deal on the cheap. Like, this to me seems like 100 cents on the dollar for a player that they covet. And ultimately, you know, I think that's probably where he and his agent will also land.
Well, in talking with the other agents in the sport, their feeling is, look, you have to look at the context of what you have on the table. You have an owner who's in his first year, who's extremely motivated in Steve Cohen. He is the richest owner in baseball. It's New York. It's the Mets. And while you might not necessarily like the 325, maybe you want to beat Fernando Tatis Jr. Maybe you want to, you know, start to approach Mookie Betts. You better recognize the situation that, you know, this is a lot of things coming together for you to get this particular offer. And on top of that, and I talked about this on the podcast yesterday, I think it's important to remember that Steve Cohen is not like crazy George Steinbrenner in the mid-80s, right? He has walked away from George Springer because he thought that was outpriced, overpriced.
That's a good point.
I thought Springer was. He walked away from JT Realmuto because he thought that potential investment is overpriced. So this is not someone who's just going to give you a blank check.
No, it's a good point. And billionaires don't become billionaires by conceding $60 million just because. I will also say, lastly, that Francisco Lindor, I think, and his representation recognize or acknowledge the possibility here for the Mets, which is a very tantalizing one. And that is, if the Mets are good and he's a big reason why, he could very easily slide into the position of the face of baseball. Like, he's the kind of player, sort of like Derek Jeter, that can make baseball fans out of people that weren't previously simply because of his popularity or his celebrity. So there's so much more that goes into this than just, how much WAR do you expect him to generate over the next 10 years? That's why obviously ownership is so heavily involved in a deal like this. It's why ownership was so heavily involved in the Bryce Harper signing in Philadelphia. We're talking about, you know, mega contracts here. And so we shouldn't be surprised that Steve Cohen's in, not only in the middle of this, but also seemingly crowdsourcing on Twitter, which is something different. And it's something that he might learn to regret.
Yeah. Well, his nickname is Mr. Smile. You talked about him being potentially the face of baseball. We are a little more than 24 hours away from the season opening up. What else you got on Lindor?
Buster, I think it's not hyperbole to say that he is on something of a Hall of Fame track. And even though I sort of poured cold water on some of his, performance-based statistics as a hitter, there are still some other ways in which the numbers can sing a very favorable tune for him. And I'll tell you how. He's played six seasons, like I mentioned. And in those six seasons, Buster, he scored more runs at this point in his career than Ernie Banks did, hit more home runs than Cal Ripken Jr. did, stole more bases than Robin Yount did, and generated more WAR than Derek Jeter did. Those are, like, if you're making a Mount Rushmore of some of the greatest shortstops of all time, all four of those guys are close to the top of that list. So we're talking about a player with premium skill across the board. Let's not forget, this is a player, even in his worst year, is still among the 10 or 15 best players in the sport. And obviously he and his agent recognize that.
Now, when he comes to the plate, it'll be against Max Scherzer, the starter for the Nationals. Tell me what you got on him.
My favorite thing about Max Scherzer, Buster, is he is so incredibly efficient and he is unafraid in attacking the strike zone. Here's what I mean. Since joining the Nationals in 2015, he has generated 342 strikeouts on three pitches. 342 times since joining the Nationals, he struck out a hitter on three pitches. That is 113 more strikeouts of that kind than any pitcher in baseball during that time. So as you're watching him throw on Thursday, obviously he had a bit of a down year by his standards last year. I'm going to be very, very curious what he does when he gets to 0-2. Is he going to be the Max Scherzer of old, or is he going to nibble a little bit? My guess is that he's going to be awfully confident in his stuff like he always is, and we'll see some more three-pitch strikeouts on Thursday.
What do you got on the Nationals' number two hitter, Juan Soto?
Oh, my goodness. I'm not sure that there's any player in baseball right now more fun to research and look into than Juan Soto, as I'm sure you're learning. And what I learned, Buster, this week was that at the age of 21 last year, he led the league in OPS. And by that measure, that means he became, I guess, sort of by default, the youngest player in baseball's modern era, which dates to 1900, to claim the title as baseball's best hitter. Again, at 21 years old, he led all qualified hitters in OPS. The previous youngest person to do that was Ty Cobb in 1909 when he led the major leagues in OPS at the age of 22. Others to do it at 22 include Stan Musial and Bryce Harper. Ted Williams did it at 23. Soto is a player who has already been the best hitter on a World Series winning team, the best hitter in baseball over the course of a full season, and now he's 22 years old. It's almost unfathomable.
And what else you got on the Nats?
Well, obviously, winning the World Series in 2019, it didn't really feel like that same team last year because, you know, they started off so slowly. Obviously, Soto had the COVID issue, and they never quite caught up to the rest of that division. But what was very curious to me in doing some game notes for you guys is that, Buster, in 2019, through 60 games, the Nats were 27-33. Last year, it was only a 60-game season, and they were 26-34, only one game worse, with a better run differential through 60 games than they were the year before, which is to say, who knows, maybe the Nationals were actually the worst team in the National League East, worse the standings indicated, or maybe, just maybe, they would have gotten themselves healthy the way that they did the year before, and they would have rode themselves all the way to a World Series championship. It just goes to show you that last season, using last season's results as the baseline for anything that we predict this year is something of a fool's errand. We should be very quick in sort of moving past our preconceptions and looking at the first few weeks of data here to sort of move past those things. Cause I think there's a really good chance that the Nationals could, you know, wind up making the playoffs this season. And that was something, look, they were the worst team in their division last year, but who knows how it would have been had we played a real season.
40 seconds. You like my idea of the Yankees pursuing Anthony Rizzo midseason if the Cubs execute a sell-off.
Yeah, it makes an awful lot of sense to me. I was listening to that podcast earlier. The Cubs seem like an obvious team to do that kind of thing because of their contract situation. I'm very curious among those four players whom they choose to identify to keep. That being said, Anthony Rizzo is just a perfect fit in Yankee Stadium. I mean, I can just picture it now. You close your eyes, Buster. You can picture it right now. someone hanging a slider, right? In October 15th, it's the ALCS, and Anthony Rizzo slipping one by the right field line the way that so many great lefties have over the course of time. I think he's tailor-made for that stadium, tailor-made for that moment. And it wouldn't surprise me, given the injury issues that the Yankees have faced recently, if they're going to be active at the trade deadline this year. I said on Greeny's radio show last week, there has never been a clearer path for the Yankees to reach the World Series because the American League is just so bad. You've been writing about it for weeks. I think that would be another example of them sort of going for it midseason the way that we thought they might last offseason. Rizzo's as good a fit as anybody that you could conjure up.
All right, Hembo. Thank you.
Later, boys.
Good League covers baseball for ESPN and does a lot around the Boston Red Sox. In June, you got Alex Cora back as manager, but you and I both know when we talk about the question about whether the Red Sox will be better than they were in 2020, it'll come back to the pitching, which was a problem for a lot of the 60 games last year. What's the state of the pitching that you see?
I think it's kind of the same. I mean, Chris Sale is still hurt. Eduardo Rodriguez is a dead arm to start the season. And, you know, even beyond just this year, I think the pitching is kind of a long-term concern for the Red Sox. If you look at the team's farm system right now, there isn't a lot of pitching talent coming up. Tanner Houck had a couple of good starts last year, but I mean, he isn't necessarily regarded as like an ace type of, or even top of the rotation type of starting pitching prospect. And a lot of the team's recent draft picks who have him, pitchers, Jay Groom, Trey Ball, they've completely, you know, haven't lived up to the expectations. And so even beyond this season, I think the pitching is kind of is generally a concern for this team moving forward.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I know from talking with folks in the organization that they feel like that they've improved the depth underneath. In other words, last year, if you compare this now to last year, that, you know, players number 25 through 50 in the organization are a lot better than they were. Heim Bloom, you know, it was a hallmark when he was with the Tampa Bay Rays of that organization. What's your sense of that, and whether or not that's the case?
I mean, I think that generally has been the strategy that this team has taken from a roster building standpoint, is to really, really improve the depth. Because I think under Dave Dombrowski, it kind of became a top heavy roster, and you kind of saw the depth fall off at the bottom of the rosters. And so when you saw injuries, the team kind of fell short in terms of filling in spots. And, you know, from everything that I've heard in terms of the strategy long term in building out this team, is that they want to be the Dodgers of the East Coast in terms of how they build out the philosophy, you know, having the flexibility to spend a lot of money when they need to, but also having that homegrown depth and that homegrown talent. The question for me with all of this is whether or not John Henry is going to be patient enough to wait all of this stuff out, and having kind of building out this like long-term approach in terms of building out a franchise, because it's kind of similar to the approach Ben Cherington took with the team. And we all know what happened, where, you know, Cherington was kind of kicked out the door. They brought in Dave Dombrowski, and Dombrowski cleared out the farm system to build a star heavy roster that obviously won the World Series. But we're kind of seeing the after effects of all that happening right now in terms of how the team is approaching building the roster back up now.
What's your sense of the practical impact of Alex Cora returning as manager?
I think it's a huge, huge cultural shift. I think there's just such an enormous sense of respect that everyone on the roster has for Alex Cora in terms of what he brings to the clubhouse on a day-to-day basis. You know, there's something that stuck out to me early in spring training that Eduardo Rodriguez said, is that, you know, as much as he's a manager for the team, he's also kind of both a coach, and he also feels like a player and a friend and a family member to so many guys on the roster. There's the bilingual strengths that obviously Cora brings to the team, and being able to speak Spanish and speak English and kind of relate to everyone. And then just on like a day-to-day basis, if you were on the Red Sox clubhouse last year and you compared it to what it was like when Alex Cora was around, the energy was just different. I mean, there's just this baseline level of energy that Alex Cora brings to the team on a day-to-day basis that is kind of hard to tangibly talk about, you know, from a stats standpoint or anything like that. But guys really love playing for Alex Cora. And I think that's something that you really can't discount when you're talking about a major league manager.
Yeah, I think one of the players most affected is Rafael Devers at third baseman. You just see a connection between he and Alex. I think Alex helped to keep him sort of like he just reinforced a lot of the good habits for Rafi when Rafi was playing well. Isn't it incredible to think that this team played in the 2018 World Series and their outfield was Andrew Benintendi and Jackie Bradley Jr. and Mookie Betts, and they're all gone? What do you make of what's in their place?
I mean, it's truly astounding to think about. You know, I was talking to one of my friends who's a big Red Sox fan last night, and I think this is the sentiment across a lot of Red Sox Nation, is that people are still angry about the Mookie Betts trade. Like, as you know, it's obviously already been a year, but the Mookie Betts trade has had such a long-term kind of implication on just how fans across New England view the team. You know, Mookie was such a beloved athlete in the city, and I think just the PR sentiment around the team is so negative right now. And, you know, I think there's just a lot of things going against the Red Sox right now. I think that if the team doesn't get off to a good start, it's going to be incredibly difficult for people to kind of jump back on this bandwagon. You know, as optimistic as you can be about guys like Alex Verdugo and Jeter Downs and people like that who came back from the Dodgers in this trade, Mookie was the most popular athlete in Boston outside of Tom Brady. And he was not only like one of the best players that this team has developed since, you know, arguably Ted Williams, but he's the second best player in this generation of baseball players behind Mike Trout. And so I think there's just so much emotion tied to Mookie and just what made him such a special and unique and a generational type player that, you know, I think the fact that, you know, Jackie Bradley Jr. and Andrew Benintendi were also incredibly beloved by this fan base. And so I just think it speaks to the fact that this is a new generation of Red Sox baseball, and there's a lot of bitterness kind of still left behind because of just the way that this past generation, this team that won the World Series a couple of years ago, kind of has fallen apart in terms of a roster building standpoint. Because, you know, I think a lot of fans expected a guy like Andrew Benintendi and Xander Bogaerts and Mookie and Jackie Bradley Jr. to be around for, you know, decade plus, you know, continuing as a member of the Red Sox. And so to see all of that kind of fall apart so quickly has been a little bit of kind of a whiplash.
We got 2 minutes and I got two questions for you. First, maybe the biggest story in the Red Sox camp was Bobby Dalbec, their power hitting corner infielder. Tell me what you see in him and what could he do this year?
I mean, he strikes me as a typical, prototypical modern power hitter in today's game, which is you expect the three outcomes. You expect a homer, you expect a walk, or you expect a strikeout. That's, you know, you can take that as a bad thing or a good thing, but I think he's going to be a guy who definitely impacts his team from an offensive standpoint. Probably going to hit lower in the order to start the season. I know around Boston, there has been some rookie of the year hype around Dalbec. I'm not sure if I would go that far, but he definitely looks like a corner infielder that is going to make as big an impact on this team as we've kind of seen in a while in terms of homegrown guys, since maybe, you know, the guys like Xander and Mookie were coming up around 2013, 2014, 2015.
How close do you think they are to the Yankees, the Rays, the Blue Jays?
I think they're in the mix for the wild card if all goes well. It's a really incredibly competitive division. You know, I think the Yankees are going to win the division. That was my pick before the season. And the Blue Jays, to me, kind of look like the White Sox of last year in terms of just young players like Bo Bichette and Vladdy Jr. and Kevin Biggio and Hyunjin Ryu at the top of that rotation. They strike me as a team that's going to start finding their stride, especially with the addition of George Springer. And then the Rays are the Rays. They always kind of refuel that roster with guys that a lot of people have never heard of. And so this is one of the most competitive divisions in baseball. And so it's going to require Chaim Bloom and company to really kind of figure out how to build on top of the depth that they added this year with guys like Kike Hernandez and Marwin. I think they're going to be in the wild card mix. I think the most optimistic potential outlook on this team is that it's similar to 2013, but I don't think they have as much pitching as they did that year. You know, I think they're going to be potentially in the wild card mix. I think they're going to miss the playoffs though.
All right, June, thanks for doing this. It'll be an interesting year in Boston. There's no doubt about it as they sort of go through this crossroad in their rebuilding effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster, Bleacher Tweets for a Wednesday. First up, we got Joe Peters at Joe Peters 17. He writes in, Buster, your suggestion to base free agency on pro years instead of service days is my favorite anti-non-competitive behavior measure I've seen. What do you think of this idea? In a player's first three seasons, the season with the fewest service days does not count. The idea is that teams will want to get the most bang for their buck and would incentivize calling up prospects as soon as possible.
Joe, I like your idea. I still like the idea of starting the clock on these players from the moment that they sign. But look, at this point, any idea that pushes teams, incentivizes teams to promote their best players is what we're looking for. And I really hope that Major League Baseball and the Player Association can work that out. My goodness, they have so many things to talk about. I cannot believe where day before the start of the season, still no DH, still no expanded playoffs. It's incredible.
Do you think that they would announce those things like three games into the season, or is this just it?
No, they would not do it three games into the season. I think they absolutely, you know, when we get the first pitch of the 2021 season, that's it. I remember last year, and we talked about this, you know, that first broadcast we had down here in Washington, Yankees and Nationals, there was pressure on the two sides to get that deal done before Max Scherzer threw the first pitch of the season. Actually, I think it was Dr. Fauci who threw the first pitch, right?
I believe so. Friend of the show. We didn't get to ask him about it, but yeah, I think you're correct there. Next up, we have the Bill Chuck Files at Billy Ball. He writes, and now that the offseason has ended, which has proven worse for baseball, the lack of any reasonable salary floor, which encourages tanking, or the luxury tax penalties, which discourages winning?
Yeah, you could do this in different ways, but I don't think there's any question. They have to find a way to compel teams to spend at least a minimal amount of money, you know, because it's clear from what we've seen going on is that these teams are cutting their payrolls to the bone. You know, the example I always cite is that one year, I think it was 2013, when the Houston Astros finished the season with one player on the entire roster making over $1 million. One player making over $1 million. And we've seen it with some of the teams this year where they just basically cut their payroll to the bone, save money, bank money, while they finished at the bottom of the standings. It's terrible.
Craziness. Next up, we have Eric E. at Esoteric Eric Zero. He writes in, just wondering if you've ever tried your hand at fantasy baseball. Us Bleacher Tweeters have a league going for a few years, and we'd save you a spot next year. Have you ever done fantasy baseball? I'm sure I've asked you this before.
Oh, yeah, plenty of times. I haven't done it in a while. We had a family, friends and family league for 17 years, and I didn't win it one time. Now, I've done a couple of office leagues back when I was at the San Diego Union. I think the Nashville Banner, and I won some of those leagues, but the Friends and Family League, I never won. I was always in the top three, but I actually never won it.
Wow. How emasculating for you in front of your friends and family.
I appreciate it. They're like just cutting me to the bone right there.
Next up, we have Andy Felt at Felt Andy. He writes in, Buster, my favorite day of the year is opening day. There's something exciting to me about the energy of the day. What is your favorite aspect of opening day?
Tomorrow, it's going to be the smells at the ballpark. I cannot wait to go to the ballpark and experience what we never experienced last year, which was to walk onto the concourse and smell the popcorn and smell the hot dogs and you know, see all the activity and the fans rolling in and just to have anything going at all. That'll be pretty cool this season, as opposed to what we experienced last year when it was just so desolate.
It's going to be like a shot in the arm, I bet.
Very nice. I like that. Way to go.
Last one for today. Debbie Gammons Brown. She writes in, is it me or has there been an uptick in injuries heading into the 2021 season? Seems counterintuitive considering the reduced game workload in 2020. What's going on with this, Buster?
I don't think there has been an uptick. I know I've been talking more on the podcast about the last 2 weeks because we've gotten to that point in spring training where, let's face it, if a guy gets hurt, you know he's not going to be ready for the start of the year. So I take some of the blame because I have focused on injuries more this year. I kind of have that of like a self-check on myself for doing that.
You and your pro-injury agenda, Buster. Unbelievable. All right. That does it for the Bleacher Tweets. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. Send in. We had a loaded one today. So please keep sending them in and do follow, rate, and review this podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
That's it for today. My thanks to Dave, Hembo, June, and Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Stay safe. Thanks for listening. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, check out the Fantasy Focus podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. The Baseball Tonight podcast.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.